Kia ora mai nā tātou, welcome back. Shane Tupou, Straight Talk. On the line now, I have former Prime Minister of Aotearoa New Zealand, Helen Clark, of course, also well known as an international diplomat. Kia ora, Helen, how are you tonight? You there, Helen?
Yes, I'm here, Shane.
Kia ora, Helen, how are you tonight?
Very good, thanks, yeah.
Now, Helen, you've recently joined an organisation that was formed by Nelson Mandela called the Elders. Can you tell us about that group, please?
Well, going back a number of years, Richard Branson, who's the owner of Virgin Airlines, but a very well-known philanthropist and progressive person. He demonstrated against the Vietnam War when he was a teenager. Richard thought there was an opportunity to set up a distinguished group of former statesmen and women who would be able to act as a force for good in the world, whether by advocacy on what needed to be done around certain issues, drawing on their experience, or actually seeking to mediate and try to, support people, countries in very difficult situations. So he approached Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was by then already a very, very old man. Nelson said, look, I'll be the patron. I can't join, but I'd like to offer you as members my wife, Graça Machel, and the Archbishop, Archbishop Tutu. And that's how it began. The organization was set up. It attracted a family of supporters, of philanthropists like Richard and others, and they began to recruit members. Kofi Annan, who was the Secretary General of the United Nations, was the head of it for a while, the president of it. Archbishop Tutu also was president at one point. And they pick up issues. So I was invited to join in June this year by Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, who's now the chair of it. And I went to the first board meeting since being invited to join in London last week with Mary, with the former president of Mexico, Ernesto Zedillo, who was just leaving as president in my first year as prime minister. There's a former president of Mongolia, Graça Machel, Nelson Mandela's widow, is still there. There's the former president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, who won the Nobel Prize for his efforts to end the half-century-long civil war in Mongolia. And, so it goes, a list of such people. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the former president of Liberia, who was a co-chair of the independent panel for pandemic preparedness and response with me. She's a member. But, really a great group of people, and many of them, I've known from the past. Another is the former UN Human Rights Commissioner, Zayed Al-Hussein from Jordan. He's a cousin of the King of Jordan, very, very articulate and trained human rights lawyer, long-time diplomat. So, we bring a lot of different experiences to the table, obviously. A former Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, she was at the meeting as well. Also she was former head of World Health Organization. So, what a wonderful group.
So a wonderful group. So a group of citizen elders that have led, and often in very troublesome times, to lend their experience and I suppose their wisdom, Helen, in terms of modern day issues that confront the world, but they're not involved in the politics of the day, Helen.
That's correct. They're keeping a close eye on global issues, and they have a strategic plan where they focus, because as we all know, this. So much going wrong in the world that if you tried to pick up every issue, you just couldn't do that. So they've picked four areas of activity, and guess what took up the most time at the meeting in London. One of the areas they pick up is conflicts, and they identified in their strategic plan, latest strategic plan, which was probably finalised in the last 18 months or so, three areas of conflict. One was the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Another was the Ukrainian war with Russia, and then a third is Myanmar, which a number, including Ban Ki-moon, who's also an elder, former Secretary General of the UN, that he's stayed active on, as have I. So, yes, we spent a lot of time discussing the Israeli-Palestinian dispute and the statement that we would issue. We obviously spent time in Ukraine, and that included talking with the chief official who supports President Zelensky in Ukraine. And then we did spend time in Myanmar. They also have a focus on nuclear weapons, which, you know, has never gone away as a problem, and is actually, you know, we're at quite a dangerous moment at the moment with, you know, Russian spokesperson from time to time threatening use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Russia's also withdrawing from, you know, key nuclear weapons agreements. They maintain a focus on pandemics, which, of course, is something I've been very involved with. And then the climate crisis is the other one, and we spent time talking about that. But given, you know, that we're meeting last week, and the war in Gaza had been, you know, very much in the news, as it still is, we did discuss that a lot. We also heard from some rather amazing people from, shall we say, both sides of the line, moderate people trying to look for ways forward, and that helped inform our views quite a lot as well.
And that's what, and that's purposefully what I want to speak to you about tonight, if I can, Helen. It's a very complex and very polarizing issue, Helen. You know me well. I'm always ready to dialogue, debate, discuss. But one of the issues that I've been very careful to not be involved in is the Israeli-Palestine conflict, because there seems to me, Helen, to be no moderates left. That there are extreme views, that and the pathway forward seems very difficult. But the group of elders have asked for a ceasefire, Helen. How, given the ferocity of the conflict, how could and would that work?
Yes, we called for a ceasefire, and there was a resolution passed in the UN General Assembly last week, which also had a large majority of countries calling for a ceasefire, which included New Zealand. I'm proud of New Zealand. New Zealand's always held a very balanced position on Israel-Palestine, always. And New Zealand has long, like most of the international community, been an advocate for establishing a Palestinian state. And the vision of the two-state solution, which was actually agreed between Yasser Arafat, PLO, and the Israeli Prime Minister of the day, Yitzhak Rabin, that's the foundation for a peace. It's also more or less backed by the Arab Peace Initiative, which was put forward by a former Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. So what the vision is that you would have two states living side by side in peace, and they need each other, right? I mean, Palestinians have labor, which your workforce, which isn't well employed, which Israel in the past has been able to make, you know, much more use of, as it were, very difficult now. And Gaza needs electricity and it needs water. So, you know, they need each other. What they don't need is a continuation of what is an unresolved dispute going back to the time of the creation of Israel. Now, as you say, there's extremists on both sides. So extremists on one side will say, you know, Palestine from the sea to the mountains, or whatever, to the river. And the others will say, you know, no Palestinian state at all. Now, neither of those positions are going to get anyone anywhere. You have to come back to what could realistically give Palestinian statehood and try to set up the basis for a future peace. You know, Israel was able to get a peace agreement with Egypt. It had in recent years started getting diplomatic relationships with more Arab states. All of that's up in the air now. You know, this conflict and what has precipitated, which was the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel, this is so bloody, so gruesome, that unless cool heads prevail now, this will set off cycles of violence for, you know, the rest of our lifetimes and our grandchildren's lifetimes.
And Helen, That's true, Helen, and it's possible that we're not just talking about within the Israeli-Gaza borders. We're talking about wider geographic consequences. That's if somehow there isn't a ceasefire and a peace process negotiated.
Yes, so it's wider spillover effect in the region, and then there's what it's doing to the global community. So on the spillover in the region, you have Hezbollah, which is basically a political and military organization in Lebanon, which in effect calls the shots in Lebanon. I mean, Shiites are far and away the majority population there. They're Shiite, they're backed by Iran, which is Shiite. There is, you know, a very, very tense border between Lebanon and a Hezbollah-controlled area in Israel now. And you can't rule out that a second front in the conflict would be open there. Then Israel also has a border with Syria, the Golan Heights, as I recall. Don't get my geography specifics, but you know the relationship with Syria is very tense. So yeah, so one of the ingredients of trying to get a ceasefire and then a serious focus on this two-state solution would be to get the support of a very wide range of stakeholders. And of their own accord, it's not so easy to get all the Palestinian factions and Israel's government, particularly in the current circumstances, led by Netanyahu, who's in his 17th year of prime ministership. You need Egypt, you need Jordan, you need the Gulf states, the Saudis, Qatar, UAE, etc. You actually are going to need Russia to come to the party because Russia has leverage with Syria, obviously. You need Iran as part of the solution. And then you need to bring in those who have been strongly supporting Israel in the West, first and foremost the United States. Now, if there's any sort of straw to clutch at in the current news, it is that President Biden has repeated twice, and his Secretary of State has said, we must move towards a two-state solution. And I'm not saying it will be easy, because the two immediate parties to this dispute are not easy to bring together, particularly after what's happened. But this is the only viable way forward. Now, one more word on the global situation. There's increasingly a very tense attitude, or set of attitudes, between what we broadly call the global north and the global south. The global north, the high-income countries, and we are one of them, in here, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the global south, which is the developing countries of the world, and of course you have China, India, Brazil as part of that. Now, the global south is very exercised about the climate crisis, which they, you know, obviously have. You know, there's a lot of very, very vulnerable countries to climate change. Absolutely. And they see the West as being all talk and not much do. A lot of money was promised at the Paris climate talks for helping developing countries to adapt and to, you know, bring down their greenhouse gas emissions. Never been delivered in full. And it was not enough anyway. So there's been a lot of bitterness about that. Then you come to the pandemic, where high-income countries, including ours, hogged all the vaccines, right? And to this day, you'll find health workers in the global south, particularly Africa, who's never had as much as a single vaccination. So there's a lot of bitterness about the inequity and in that, gross inequity, gross injustice. So then you come to the Ukraine war, which, you know, comes when we're 2 years into the pandemic. And the West goes around saying, put up your hands for Ukraine. And the global south says, well, bother you, blow you. And Ukraine, and I'm totally supportive of the Ukraine cause, but Ukraine has really struggled to get global solidarity because of this bittering resentment in the global south, which, you know, I mean, there's never been apologies for, you know, in New Zealand, we're used to apologizing, right? We're apologizing.
Yes,
we make apologies for colonization. We make apologies for, you know, the dreadful wrongs that were done. When did the US ever apologize for slavery? When did the UK ever apologize for slavery and colonization? When did France, you know, the Netherlands, Germany, Spain,
Belgium,
the rest of it? Belgium, there's never been apologies.
And some of them have pretty horrific recent histories, Helen.
Shocking history. So, a lot of the countries in the global south who had to fight for their independence got support from Russia, right?
Yeah.
So, and the if you take South Africa, the Communist Party of South Africa is powerful in the ANC and the government to this day. But there's many other countries where, you know, when the US and UK and, you know, including New Zealand, when we were happy to play apartheid sport, right, or some people were, not me, not you.
No, not us, Alan.
So, you know, a lot of the high-income countries looked the other way. It took a long time to get a unified front against apartheid in South Africa. And, of course, colonization went for, you know, in some cases, several centuries. So never been apologies for that. So then come to this war. What do people see throughout the world? That a high-income country is bombing and killing thousands of civilians in the Gaza Strip, populated by over 2 million Palestinians, many of them refugees from the formation of Israel. These people are under siege. They've got no power. They've got no Wi-Fi. They've got no food. They've got no water. I had a message from a friend whose mother was trapped in one of the urban areas in Gaza. She says that every day her son walks 3 kilometers to the sea to get seawater. Well, you know what happens when you drink seawater? It destroys your kidneys. I mean, it's a desperate and terrible situation. And what people in the south are seeing and what many of us are seeing is too little done by the chief supporters of Israel to bring this to a halt. So, you know, this is making for a very toxic atmosphere at the United Nations.
Can I ask a question, Helen? Can there be negotiations around a ceasefire with Hamas being active in Gaza?
You know, this sort of, quote, elimination of Hamas reminds me of the Vietnam War and, quote, the elimination of what the Americans call the Viet Cong, right, who were the South Vietnamese who were fighting the old regime backed by North Vietnam, which was communist. So they were all demonized. You were never going to, quote, eliminate, quote, the Viet Cong because it expressed the desire of Vietnamese people for something different. And with Hamas, you have the armed wing of it. You also have moderates in Hamas. I mean, this might not be the most popular thing to say to all elements, but you do have people who will talk, but no one wants to hear about them. So I think, quote, the elimination of Hamas is meaning leveling whole urban areas of Gaza to try and get to the tunnels that are underneath. And in the process, thousands of civilians are killed because you're bombing their homes, you're bombing the hospitals they've taken refuge in, you're bombing the schools they've taken refuge in. You know, they're given warnings by Israel that they must move out of that part and go to the south. There are people who have been killed on the move south. You know, the cars have run out of fuel, so you try to find a donkey and a cart. There's not enough of them. I mean, this is an horrific situation. So
we're talking about because we are talking about a very small piece strip of land that is highly intensified in terms of population density. And a very young population at that.
That's right. It would be, you know, like many developing country populations, you'd be looking at least 2/3, I would think, who are you know, children and young people, let's say under 25. So, yeah, huge youth population. There's not much land that isn't urbanized in Gaza. There's a little bit with fields, but not much. So, you know, desperate situation. So if the goal is, quote, to eliminate Hamas, a lot more of Gaza will be leveled and a lot more people will be killed. So what should happen, and I've been calling for this on my Twitter site for some time, is regardless of what term you use, is it a sustained truce, which is what the UN General Assembly resolution said, which we voted for, is it, quote, a ceasefire? Is it a sustained humanitarian pause? You know, whatever it is, stop fighting. Stop killing each other. And there are rockets going from Hamas, by the way, into Israel as well. Stop this. Now, then you allow the aid convoys to come in. And you could do that under supervision if that's the deal, right? You could have the International Confederation of the Red Cross supervising the deliveries. They seem to have a little bit more trust from both sides. So they did get something over the border the other day. Then you say the hostage release negotiation, because one of my many concerns now is that with the hostages there, you will end up seeing hostages either killed in the bombing or killed by extremists among Hamas who say, you know, we're just going to make our point. Kill people. I mean, there's over 200 hostages. Mm. You know, I saw the coverage of the meeting that a number of the Israeli families had with Netanyahu, and they said to him, we want our family back. You know, we want our family back. That's got to be the first priority. But at the moment, it doesn't look like it's the first priority, because the more the bombing goes on in Gaza, the more people are killed there, the more the hostages are at huge risk. So, you know, stop the fighting. Go to the negotiation for the hostage release and let the supplies in. Now, if you can do that, then you know, the diplomacy, which should be going busily on the background now, which requires a lot of people who don't like each other at all to talk to each other, and that includes the Russians, the Iranians, the Americans, the Arab states, everyone has to come to bear to say, we do not want this cycle of violence to continue through more generations. We have to focus on the establishment of the Palestinian state, which will live side by side in peace with Israel. I know it sounds impossible, but actually that is the only thing that is going to end this for once and all.
And Helen, I'd like to offer our listeners this hope and get your comment on it. In my lifetime, there have been, that I can easily think of, two intractable forces where peace never looked likely, and within a quick and reasonably quick time, peace was achieved and held out and held well. Northern Ireland, South Africa, both not perfect, but Helen, there were times not long before the peace negotiations and the formation of New South Africa that there seemed no hope.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes someone will step up who can make a difference. If you take the end of apartheid in South Africa, which just was so also horrific, the person who stepped up was F.W. de Klerk, who came out of the Afrikaner National Party. He'd got to where he was, presumably by playing along. And he, when he became president, had the wisdom to see that they could not carry on like that. And he put out the hand of friendship to Mandela. First, Mandela was released from Robben Island. He got to talk to de Klerk, and the two of them got a Nobel Prize together, because Mandela said to the armed wing of his movement, stop, we're going to negotiate this. And de Klerk said to the apartheid state, we have to move on from this. Now, you know, probably many on the extreme of, you know, the white community in South Africa probably never forgave de Klerk, but he did the right thing. And, you know, we need people now who will do the right thing. Right?
That's true. Hey, Helen, I want to thank you very much for being on with us tonight, giving us the perspective, and look forward to talking to you and listening to you more about the vast body of your work, including the Mahayu Doom with the Elders. That's Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of Aotearoa New Zealand. Kia ora.
Thanks, Shane. Kia ora.